You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Psst, hey you, want to buy some Greek bonds? Boy, have we got a deal for you. What could possibly go wrong? Speaking of which, did you see the stock market today? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 10th of April today. Good to have you with us. It's a Thursday, which honestly is kind of funny because the news out of the White House late this afternoon, according to press reports, felt like it should be one of those Friday afternoon things where the administration hopes that whatever they have to say gets buried in the push to the weekend. Kathleen Sebelius has, it is being widely reported, resigned. Marketplace's David Gura is on the story for us in Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
Secretary Sebelius was widely criticized here and elsewhere for the health care rollout, but she kind of did what they set out to do, right? I mean, they did just mark 7.5 million signups for this thing.
That's right. I mean, they exceeded their goals. She was actually on the Hill today testifying before lawmakers that they've reached 7.5 million enrollees, as you said. And it was only a few weeks ago that she announced that, that the White House announced that they'd hit 7 million, so more than they'd initially forecasted. So you could say, yes, I mean, this has been a success in some regard. Of course, there were problems. You mentioned that disastrous rollout of healthcare.gov, the health insurance marketplace back in October. It's worth pointing out, that she's been there for a while. I think there are six members of President Obama's cabinet who are still in those offices today. She's one of them. She was the governor of Kansas and came to this job after Tom Daschle was initially appointed for the position.
Right.
Didn't work out in his favor.
That was a long time ago, huh?
Exactly. But she's been there for about 5 years, and the announcement is expected, I think, tomorrow.
Were they just waiting till this deadline thing passed and they marked that 7.5 million before deciding that she would leave, do you think?
That's a great question. I think you've got to think. Yes. I mean, around the time that there had been so much trouble with that federal insurance marketplace,
right,
there were certainly calls for her resignation. She actually went up to the Hill and said to lawmakers, hold me accountable. If you're going to hold someone accountable, it's me. That didn't happen. You know, I think you point out rightly that this would have been a distraction ahead of that deadline, ahead of that goal. They wanted to show that things were back on track, going the way they were supposed to be going, and they wanted that focus to be sort of wholly, completely on that recent deadline.
Does this, do you think, substantively change anything for the Affordable Care Act?
You know, it's still got a ways to go, of course, and there's a bit of reprieve here. The enrollment period has ended. It starts up again in November for the following year. They've picked somebody for this job, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, who's not a political figure. I think that's a strategic move on their part. She has a strong resume. She went to Harvard. She went to Oxford. She has a background in economics and development. She worked as a management consultant. She's not, at face, a polarizing figure. She comes from the Office of Management and Budget, which is, sort of a breeding ground for leading lights in the Obama White House. Jacob Lew was there. Peter Orszag was there. So, it's she's going to head an agency. It's a big agency, the biggest federal agency, and she's got a lot to deal with. 24 states haven't agreed to expand their Medicaid programs, and, we're facing this midterm election where this is the paramount issue in so many states. We can expect just a ton of negative ads, and this is going to be a really big election issue.
Right. So spitball it for me, a Washington political reporter of ours. She's going to have to be confirmed. She's going to go up to the Hill right in front of the Senate. I mean, there's going to be a lot of whacks taken at the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, and I think they're counting on those whacks being taken at the act itself and not at her.
Huh.
She had to be approved for the position she's in now, and she did enjoy bipartisan support for that. So, I think the White House must feel reasonably safe that she's a sure bet to get approved.
David Gura in Washington for us on the resignation, it is being reported, of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius this evening. An announcement expected, we are told, tomorrow. David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Be good. On Wall Street today, just because that's what we do on this broadcast, don't make me tell you, you guys. You don't want to know. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Let us pause for just a moment as we get going here. A pause, what, for perspective, I guess. We will skip right over the events of the day on Wall Street with a single word. Ugly would be that word. And we'll go back to the depths of the European debt crisis when Greece was all but insolvent. International investors were rightly headed for the hills and the end of the Eurozone was nigh. And now look at them. The Greek finance ministry went back to the long-term debt market today with buyers falling all over themselves to get in on the five-year Greek bond action. There is, of course, an asterisk to this story. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has it.
The good news, Greece's economy is improving. The bad, the government's still heavily in debt. A quarter of the population's unemployed, and there are frequent strikes against austerity measures. Sure, fiscal reforms and bailouts from the EU and IMF pulled the country back from the brink. But why invest in Greece now? The answer begins with European Central Bank President Mario Draghi speaking almost 2 years ago.
The ECB is ready to do whatever it takes to preserve the euro.
At that point, investors said, oh, Greece is not really risky. It's being backed by the full faith and credit of the eurozone.
Economist Barry Bosworth at the Brookings Institution says investors now believe no eurozone country, even Greece, will be allowed to default or pull out of the common currency. They're all too big to fail. So maybe they're worth a flutter. Greece's credit rating is lousy, but it's paying investors pretty high interest, nearly 5%, more than they'd get on U.S. or German bonds. Strategist John Canali at LPL Financial.
Global investors are still looking for attractive places to put their cash.
But Canali says we'd all be better off in the long run if they'd invest their cash in factories or companies in the U.S. or healthy emerging markets instead of chasing high-interest debt from a country that's burned them before. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 could go on for years and years, which is to say that it's not an inexpensive business, this open-ocean deep-water recovery operation. Technology could have made the whole thing shorter and cheaper, as well as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Australia is spending $500,000 a day on just one of its ships. The U.S. has already spent millions. China, Australia, Malaysia, Britain, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea have all spent money and resources looking for this plane, too.
If the airline industry were not permitted to externalize all these costs to the taxpayers of probably two dozen nations looking for this particular aircraft, they might behave differently.
That's Robert Mann. He's an airline industry analyst, and he says there are products currently available that could have made this search a lot quicker.
The owners of corporate aircraft install tracking technology, which is available off the shelf.
He says it costs around $3,000 a plane, and it's used because the owners of corporate aircraft have made a cost-benefit analysis of corporate execs' time.
No, we can't have the CEO out of pocket for, you know, more than a minute. We have to know exactly where that individual is.
Commercial airlines, he says, have not made the same assessment for everyone else. Steve Trimble is with Flight Global magazine. He says even medium-end services that transmit data more regularly are expensive but affordable.
For example, for American Airlines to install this system on each one of their 900 aircraft, that adds up to about $50 million, you know, which is a pretty big bill for any individual airline to swallow. Of course, American Airlines happened to make $2 billion last year in profit.
It will never happen unless it becomes a regulation.
Mary Schiavo is a former inspector general for the U.S. Department of Transportation. She now represents airline accident victims. She says the best solution would be to constantly stream information from the cockpit to satellites. That may be the best solution, but it's also the most expensive and, therefore, probably the least likely. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There was a story in the Wall Street Journal this week that caught our eye. It was about companies getting rid of their HR departments. No more human resources, just like that. They're using software for stuff like payroll, and they're having regular line managers pick up the stuff HR used to do. As to whether that works or not, well, I don't know, which is why we've called Nancy Kane. She is a historian at the Harvard Business School. She joins us from time to time to talk about things like this. Nancy, it's good to have you back.
Always a real pleasure, Kai.
It is, I will say, on the face of it, a curious, interesting. It's an interesting idea, getting rid of HR departments.
It is. There's something seductive about the logic of it, you know, among the, you know, anecdotal evidence and stories we have from companies that have chosen to do this, which is, well, let's put the people decision making and the people issues right in the business, right, as opposed to separating them out in a separate function. Seductive, cost cutting.
You don't sound convinced. I'm just going to get right to the chase here. You do not sound
convinced.
I'm
not convinced at all. So the historian in me wants to tell you that HR, or what we call human resources,
yeah,
which used to be personnel management,
right, yeah,
which used to be industrial relations, which was once way back when industrial welfare,
wow,
evolved, right, as workers and factories and management evolved almost, you know, in tandem. And there's a reason that early 21st century companies of any size end up having a people or a partner or a human resource department. And I think those reasons are bigger and more critical than simply we can outsource payroll, we can outsource,
yeah,
benefits without, you know, separate stewards of all the other issues that,
right,
are critical both to employees and companies in the equation.
These intermediaries, right? So let me ask you to lay those out, because there's a not small slice of the people listening to this interview, and it's people who don't work in HR, right? But they will say, oh man, HR, they're the ones who make me take the trainings, they're the ones who make me,
yeah,
do the evaluations and the forms and the blah, blah, blah. So make the case. By the way, no aspersion to HR professionals out there everywhere.
Absolutely
right.
Not. The overwhelming majority of whom are women, all the way up to the C-suite, right? There is no other single,
yep,
executive function at the very top of companies that is so occupied by women. So I think it's interesting that we talk about slicing off and getting rid of a critical function.
Mm-hmm.
It's overwhelmingly a female function.
Hmm.
Having said that, let's do it in kind of David Letterman-like, you know, ascending.
Right.
Ascending.
Or Stephen Colbert style. Who knows what that's
going to be. Or Stephen Colbert,
right,
style. So let's start with the most boring and mundane, but they're also important, right? There are issues, legal issues, right? Is the company and is the employee compliant with existing regulation?
Right.
Pay. But there's one more thing. Think about the Ritz-Carlton or Southwest Airlines or even Estee Lauder. These are companies that have very, very high levels of customer loyalty. And these are also companies that invest in huge amounts of human resource management. And there's no surprise. Why? Because an engaged, satisfied, non-bickering workforce that's legally compliant is critically important to, you know, the ka-ching, ka-ching of winning in the marketplace and having, if you will, a high EPS.
HR and ka-ching. Ching, ka-ching. There you have it. Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Thank you, Nancy.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Coming up, for the directionally challenged among you, good news.
You have to try to get lost. You have to disconnect yourself from pretty much modern society.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, I'll tell you what, I really thought it would have been wah-wah trombones there, but all right, we'll go with this. The Dow Industrials tumbled 266 points today, 1.6%, closed at 16,170. The NASDAQ plunged 129 points. Yeah, no, I don't get to choose the music, do I? More than 3%. Finished at 4,054. That is the NASDAQ's biggest percent decline in a single day since 2011. By the by, the S&P off 39 points, more than 2%. Ended things at 1833. Tech and biotech took things south today. Shares in Facebook tumbled more than 5%. Google off 3.5%. Biogen IDEC down almost 4.5% today. First day of trading for Ally Financial, the former General Motors financing arm. Shares were priced at $25, slipped 4% on the day. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its producer price index for March. Iowans were the first to pay a state tax on cigarettes. A 2 cent per pack tax was imposed on April 11th, 1921. And foodies probably already know that it's National Cheese Fondue Day. What beats things dipped in cheese? Help me. I'm drawing a blank. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The retail chain Family Dollar said today it's going to close more than 300 stores. Shrinking sales and falling profits are the proximate causes. Now, there is a line of thinking that says if a discount store like Family Dollar is reporting bad news like this, maybe that's good news for the broader economy. Chrissy Clark from the Wealth and Poverty Desk explains why and why there is more to the story than just that.
There's this chart that a Family Dollar executive showed during a presentation recently at a retail conference. It had a timeline of all these bad moments in the American economy, highlighted in blue. The decline in the manufacturing industry in the late 80s, the recession that came after 9/11, the subprime mortgage crisis. And yet, weirdly, this chart was labeled History of Success.
Family Dollar has a proven business model with a long track record of success.
Mary Winston is the CFO of Family Dollar. She was presenting this timeline. And the point she was making was that right on the heels of all these economic shocks, as many other retailers floundered, Family Dollar's earnings boomed.
We've weathered many difficult economic times.
I mean, that's how it works for these dollar stores.
Anthony Chikumba is senior research analyst with BB&T Capital Markets, which has investments across the discount chain industry.
In tough economic times, higher income consumers who don't typically shop at dollar stores start shopping at Family Dollar. Basically, there's a trade-down impact.
But now, those customers who traded down to shop at dollar stores are beginning to trade back up to higher-end stores as the economy starts to recover, Chikumba says. And on top of the higher-income folks who've left Family Dollar.
Family Dollar's target low-income consumer is just tapped out at this point.
Chikumba says the recovering stock market, the recovering housing market, those things don't have as much effect on low-income consumers. What does have an effect are recent cuts to things like food stamps and unemployment benefits, meaning those low-income families,
their economic prospects continue to be fairly dim.
Still, some discount stores like Dollar General and Dollar Tree are doing better than Family Dollar right now. Their prices are usually about 5% lower. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You hear about a business lawsuit in which the amount at issue is a relatively paltry $20 million, and you might not think much of it. If you want relevance, the number's got to start with a B, right? This dispute, however, merits a mention because it's all about fonts, typeface. Graphic designers Tobias Frere-Jones and Jonathan Heffler worked together for 15 years, in the process creating some of the most ubiquitous fonts out there for GQ, Martha Stewart, even Saturday Night Live. The two, though, have now come to a parting of the ways, hence the $20 million lawsuit. But who knew there was so much money in typography anyway? Well, turns out Sally Herships did.
First, tiny disclaimer. I went to art school, so I know about the business of type. Carol Waller with the Type Directors Club tells students the same thing I do.
All around you, in your office, doesn't matter. The books in front of you, that's all type. Somebody's designed that font.
And somebody else paid for it.
Newspapers, magazines, branding companies, they will actually have a typeface designed for their brand, and then nobody else can use it.
Which, Waller says, means some type can cost thousands. A fee for one font for one computer could run from $20 to $100. Get a popular font, and you do the math. Helvetica is used so much, there's even a documentary about it.
Well, you know, this is, I think, the core of the Jonathan Heffler, Tobias Frere-Jones lawsuit is a lot of the work that came out of that studio was very, very popular.
James Montalbano is a typography designer with Terminal Design.
Then a lot of type designers do work on sort of the equivalent of a putting out a rock record or a pop record. You know, you have an idea, you put together a font, and then you release it to the design public. and hopefully you'll have a hit.
And $20 million is what Tobias Fair Jones is asking for in compensation. He wasn't available for comment. But when asked if fonts were worth that much, designer Jonathan Heffler said in a statement, typography is an integral part of the business world. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We went out yesterday on social media and asked listeners about fonts and in the process learned something. Y'all are font nerds. Hundreds of you took our survey, and so far we know two things about you. You kind of like Calibri, but you hate, hate, hate Comic Sans. If you want to weigh in, and come on, you know you do, the survey is up at marketplace.org. Chances are, right this very second, you could, without too terribly much trouble, figure out how to get from where you are to almost any place else on the planet. If you don't happen to have your phone in your pocket, fire up your desktop or your laptop, and boom, there you are. But there is more than just mapping going on here. Hiawatha Bray is a technology reporter for the Boston Globe, and he is the author of a new book about our highly mapped society and all that that entails. It is called You Are Here. Hiawatha, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
It is now basically impossible to get lost, you write. So let's start with what that means.
Well, you can if you really, really work at it.
You got to
try, that's the point.
Right? Yeah.
You have to try to get lost. You have to disconnect yourself from pretty much modern society.
Make the value judgment for me. Good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, in terms of knowing other people knowing where you are, it's a mixed bag. In terms of you knowing where you are and where other things are and where other people are, I think it's almost all good. I mean, the whole idea of being able to navigate through the world with a higher degree of reliability is one of the most challenging technical problems the human race has ever faced, and it's taken us centuries to beat it. But when you know how to do that, you can now go anywhere from, you know, the farthest reaches of our own planet all the way to the moon.
And you sound excited about this, as you clearly are. You've written a book about it. However, comma, what cost has it come at, this ability to know where we are down to the meter, practically?
Well, it's obviously raised a serious concern about the threat to privacy, because so many of the technologies, in some cases, technologies that weren't even invented for that reason, like the smartphone, or not even the smartphone, just any cell phone. By the very nature of how a cell phone works, it tracks your location. Other example would be the EasyPass toll systems that all use so that we don't have to throw money into a toll booth. And one day it suddenly occurred to people, hey, wait a minute. We now know every time somebody has driven down a toll road. Now we have license plate scanners. You may have heard about this.
Mm-hmm.
Both police agencies and private companies are simply putting up scanners that identify car license plates as you drive down the road and building up databases. And there's no limit right now in, under law for how long you can keep those records, which means that if you're in a city where these license plate readers are pervasive, they can have conceivably years of records of where you've driven.
Is the message then of this new mapping society, forget phone records and the NSA and knowing what they say, but it is the message now, at least as regards our physical location, you have no privacy, get over it, to quote Scott McNeely?
Well, that's the way it's currently shaping up. The only real solution that I can think of in the long run is that we're going to have to come up with some kind of legislative solution that sets limits on how this location data can be used.
I get that, and I appreciate it, but here's the thing. What you're talking about, in essence, is some kind of checks and balances, which works reasonably well in a constitutional framework when you have democracy involved. But what you have now with specifically these applications, and yes, there's government involved, but you have private corporations who have a profit motive in knowing where you are so they can sell to you and market to you and track you, whether it's inside the Apple store or driving down the freeway. How then do you have checks and balances in that situation?
Well, surely you can have legislative limits on that, too. I mean, you can model stuff after, like, the credit law. What is it called? The Fair Credit Act? But as you know, credit bureaus, by law, have to tell you what they know about you and have to give you some control over the ability to correct errors, for example. That's one thing that's an obvious thing that we could do by law. If a company has this information about you, they must give it to you if you ask for it. They must give you the option to correct any information. And also, if it's a commercial company, you should have the right to say, delete it.
Yeah, one of the things you do at the end of the book is you sort of hypothesize about how we might get our privacy back in this day and age when we can't really lose ourselves. How do we do that? How do we get ourselves lost again now that we've been there, you know?
Well, no, in terms of actually getting lost, I don't see that happening. I don't think I want to get lost anymore. I just want others not to constantly track my location.
Hi, Awatha Bray. He's a technology reporter at the Boston Globe. His book on mapping past, present, and future is called You Are Here. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, to which one can only say zut alors, sacre bleu, and how do I get me some of that action? From France, home of the 35-hour work week, comes this item. Tech sector employees over there have just struck a new collective bargaining agreement, under the terms of which they are guaranteed that after-hours emails, as in the kind we all check on our phones while at a kid's soccer game or making dinner, will not impinge on the aforesaid 35-hour week. Workers now have the unimpeded right to unplug at quitting time. Speaking of which, that's where we are. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 1.6%, closed at 16,170. The NASDAQ cratered more than 3%, finished at 4,054. The S&P 500 off 39 points, more than 2% today. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.